We're back at it. God damn it, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, but his dick is too fast for love. It's Mr. Rob motherfucking Fortune.
Thank you for that introduction. Now I'd like to introduce this man. He's in East LA at midnight. Papa won't come home tonight. He's running 50 miles and then taking a bath in ice. It's Jomo.
Yeah, that, you know what? That was actually a great fucking entrance, but the whole fucking taking a bath in ice, it hurts so fucking bad, dude. It's such a big pain, but thank you for that, Rob. You're always a gentleman and a scholar, so I appreciate that.
Nice.
Yeah, man, just getting ready for these runs, man. Got a 50-miler next month. But you guys aren't joining me, which is like, oh, come on, come on.
Yeah, that's your suffering. I got my own shit going on.
Very good. Very good. All right. We all told him he's too young to fall in love. It's Mr. Jack Falcon.
Yo, that was crisp.
That has to be some cheap ass shit.
No, that's a polar. Yo, wow. Here's the thing when it comes to like cold showers and stuff. I'm too big of a bitch to do it. I keep trying to psych myself into it. And the shower in my basement, when I first moved in, like you had to take the, someone had just fixed the shower. So they didn't adjust it properly. So it was only cold. Right. And I was like, psych. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take cold showers down there. And then my buddy came over and fixed it. And now I'm just too big of a bitch to do it. But I need to fucking start doing it. That's what men do.
Yeah.
How often do you do that, Jomo?
After serious long runs, man, like if I'm going on a serious run, but the way I supplement, I rarely get skeletal issues or anything joint related. I rarely get those issues, but the big part of it is like cooling down and reducing inflammation, man. And,
yeah,
and it's really good for the body, man. So I tell anyone, just take a cold shower, take about a 10-minute cold shower. You know, start off hot, you know, and then transition to mild and lukewarm and then super cold. And it helps out, man. I mean, it helps me and it's good for your brain and all that shit. So
do you think your joints are going to be fucked when you're 50?
Oh, guaranteed though. Yeah. I'm fucked now, but let's kick some in the news. Jack Falcon, anything happened to you recently?
Yeah, I got married the other day. Halloween.
You got married?
Yeah, Beck and I got married on Halloween, yeah.
No shit.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Oh.
So, yeah, went to Boston. It's been planned for quite a while. We planned it in like August or something. So, yeah, it was just a town hall up there or whatever, city hall, whatever. Mm. Yeah, nothing crazy.
No shit, dude. How do you feel?
Same. I mean, Becca and I've been together for like almost 10 years now. We own this condo together, so.
Yeah, she's like, hurry the fuck up.
Yeah, yeah.
Sick of waiting.
Yeah, she's been living in sin too long. What's up?
We used to joke all the time, like, you know, she her ring size is 6.5 and 7, right. And it was like, oh, she's not going to wait around forever. And then radio silence for like a year or two, and that you have to do it eventually, and good job.
You know what's funny is I didn't tell her this. Well, I told her this afterwards, but like probably like a month ago, like I got her ring in the mail and she was like, yo, I just want to try it on to make sure it fits, right? We were like laying in bed. So she's like, yo, go get it and just put it on so I can feel it if it like make sure it fits. Mm-hmm. And so I went and got it. And when I put it on, like, I don't know why, but like I popped like an immediate boner, right? Mm-hmm. And I told her like we wanted to go get some food like on the like the day afterwards. I told her about that. And she was like, "Oh, that's actually like really sweet." So
nice.
Yeah.
It's not gonna suck itself.
No, get your head down there. Mm. Yeah.
I got a boner.
But yeah. So that did happen.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a good time.
And you're about to get miserable, but it's all right. Let's talk. other than that terrible segue, let's talk about The Crew.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to talk about Motley Crue today, four albums. So these are, pretty much the lineup of Motley Crue remained the same through their entire career. There's one album where they had a different singer, but for the most part, it's Nikki Sixx on bass, Tommy Lee on drums, Vince Neil, who's the singer, and Mick Mars, who's a guitar player. And around, I want to say the second album or third, the band wanted to kick Mick Mars out. So Mick Mars was like something like 10 years older than the rest of the band. And so they wanted to boot him out at some point, and they never actually did it. Mick Mars is now out of the band. He was booted out, I think, last year, 2022, and he officially left in 2023. John Five took his place. He's playing with Motley Crue now. But besides that, I don't remember who the other singer was who came in for one album in like 91 or some shit, but no one cares about him anyway, so it doesn't matter. We ready to start this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought we were starting it. What the fuck?
Oh, well, I meant like diving into a record. Yeah. Okay. Jumbo, does this cover art turn you on?
Dude, I get hard boner feels right. Like, dude, this is Leather Daddy feels on the Leather Daddies.
That's definitely Leather Daddy feels. All right, Too Fast for Love's a 10-track record released in 1981, coming in just under 40 minutes long. It's the band's debut studio album, reaching number 77 on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart, and contains the singles Stick to Your Guns and Livewire. The first edition of 900 copies was released on November 10th, 1981, on the band's original label, Leather Records. There are three known vinyl pressings of the Leather Records version, along with one known cassette. Elektra Records signed the band the following year, at which point Too Fast was remixed and partially re-recorded and re-released in 1982. This release, with a different track listing and slightly different artwork, has become the standard version from which all later reissues derive. The re-recorded album also removed the song Stick to Your Guns, though it is featured as a bonus track. The original mix remained unreleased on CD until 2002, when it was included in the Music to Crash Your Car to Volume 1 box set compilation. Yo, that title is like cringy shit, and we'll get to that in a later album. The first recording session was in October 1981, and a half year later, the band first played the Starwood nightclub. They recorded for a few days at Hit City West, a small studio in the Hollywood district of Los Angeles. Vince Neil said in 2000, "It was amazing because everyone had passed on us the first time around. We were just happy when someone was prepared to mass produce our records so that we could go on real tours." In 1996, Motley Crue and Elektra split. The band once again formed their own record company, Motley Records, and re-released all the albums before New Tattoo. The 2002 version of Too Fast for Love adds the Leather version of Too Fast for Love, Stick to Your Guns, Toast to the Town, the Raspberries cover song Tonight, and a live version of Merry-Go-Round. The cover art is an homage to the Rolling Stones' 1971 album Sticky Fingers. Too Fast for Love has been certified platinum. Rob, what do you think of Too Fast for Love?
So I'm really glad that we did this band, because this is one of those bands that I fucking loved when I was 8 years old, and I didn't know if like that made me fucking lame or what that meant. But so I wanted to check out this band. So first of all, it turns out I've listened to this band a bit more than I thought. Like, this girl made me an 80s metal mix a long time ago, and I remember like asking her like, "Who made this song? Who made this song?" I'm trying to like fucking repeat back the lyrics that I understood. I have like an audio issue, so I can't like understand lyrics when I hear them. So she couldn't tell me. But yeah, one of the songs on that mix was "Live Wire." I fucking love that song. I do now, and I did then. Song has fucking balls. Okay, yeah, a couple things about like that song and this album in general. Like, something sounds kind of out of tune on this album. I think it's the singer. The singer sounds like kind of flat to me a bunch of the time. And like but that's the only album I'm gonna say this about. Like, he gets some of the grit like starting next album. So I think, you know, sometimes I'm listening to this album and I'm like, the singer doesn't feel like he fits. He's just kind of like, his muscles aren't there, and he's not, but you know, the band just got started. And so for, you know, if you made your first album and you aren't there yet, and you know, that's fucking normal. So, but anyways, even with those complaints that I just said, I feel like this album has fucking balls and like energy. Like, Livewire, I love like all the riffing in it, and like even at the end. Okay, so Nikki Sixx isn't much of a bass player. I watched this fucking documentary, and fucking everyone's just trashing him about how bad of a bass player he is. What fucking balls that dude has. He's like, "I want to be a rock star. I don't don't know how to play an instrument. I don't have an instrument. And then he like, you know, he's not getting along with his family. So he just fucking moves to LA, still can't play an instrument. But like, yeah, I'm going to be a fucking rock star, even though I don't know how to play an instrument. I mean, I don't know whether this dude's fucking crazy or what. Well, I mean, he is crazy, but like, one thing about him, he has something that Ozzy Osbourne has. He knows how to find good people to pair himself with. Everything you just said about how they were going to kick out fucking Mick Miller, the guitar player or whatever, that to me is insane, because Nikki Sixx's fucking entire fucking success is he was going to shows in the area. He picked all the like best musicians he thought he would gel with, and then he stayed with those people that he picked for fucking ever, and like had all this success. He picked people who were better than him, and like they elevated him. So it's fucking crazy that they wanted to kick out the guitar player, because I think he's the best member of this band. But anyways, okay, yeah. So yeah, end of Livewire. There's this fucking like, I don't know if it's all in on odd time signatures or not, but it has this like tech feel to it. Okay, these guys don't have the whatever to be, you know, the fucking Dillinger escape plan or whatever. But I wouldn't be surprised if, this is humble beginnings for what comes later. It's like, for a band, Motley Crue is a fucking pop band. For a band that's like metal, it's fucking pop. But yeah, like for them to include some moments like that where it isn't all about the pop, it's about unpredictability and it's about something else. Yeah, I fucking love that moment. And another thing, another way that I got introduced to this band in like the wrong way. Imagine me at 16 and, you know, so-and-so told me that, you know, cock rock is awful. Everything that came out of the 80s is awful and brainless, and it's all about fucking babes and like there's no substance there or whatever. So all those people are like, Tommy Lee is one of the best drummers of all time. And I'm like, oof. Oh, fuck. No fucking way. It's just like, you know, Thomas Hawk or nothing. But anyways, I'm going to say, I also watched Pam and Tommy, the Hulu show that, like a year ago. So think about this. I've barely listened to Motley Crue, and then I'm told that this fucking 80s drummer is one of the best drummers of all time. I don't fucking believe it. And then I watched like a movie about like what is it? A Me Too type situation where it's where, and then yeah, so I like Pam and Tommy, they make Tommy into like he's quite the villain in that show. His character is hilarious, but I won't say every fucking spoiler, but he's not a good person, and maybe nobody in this fucking band is a good person. But I'll leave that up to behind the music or whatever, you know. Anyways, back to this fucking album, Starry Eyes. Okay, so I had an up and down week with this album in particular. Once I did the research and discovered that they have one guitar player. Yeah, there's this moment in Starry Eyes in the chorus and in which I'm like, this is kind of like a naked riff. I'm not like sure if I love this or if it's incomplete feeling. But yeah, I forgot that at this time in history, most metal bands had one guitar player. It wasn't until like kind of later that the two guitar player thing is, you know, now like, you know, you go on fucking TikTok and every like guitar player is tapping a million chords and fucking whatever. Shit's busy right now. So I'm listening to Starry Eyes and I'm trying to decide, is this awesome? Is this fucking not enough? I'm gonna say fucking thumbs up. It took me a second to get used to it, but like yeah, once I accepted that this kind of has like a three-piece vibe, you know, well, one guitar player vibe, I started to get into it. I don't know. Another thing about this album, they don't have the fucking gang vocals that come later. So, okay. So like when I say that this album isn't there yet, it's like, the guitar. There are these moments in which I feel like things are out of tune and there's not enough guitars. There's moments in which the singer is like flat out of tune. Not, and then there's like, there's no fucking gang vocals yet. I come to love the gang vocals for, but they aren't there yet. But anyways, even so, I fucking love this album. I don't know. I think there's a charm here and there is a fucking funness to this album and this band. I don't know if this makes me lame, but this band is fucking fun. They don't bum me out. And I don't know, there's a certain oh, and by the way, this was not cringe at the time. These guys banged everybody. These guys, this was a fucking famous band that everybody fucking loved. And anybody who says that they're fucking cringe or whatever, they're not getting how fucking big this band was. But yeah, I don't give a shit. I fucking had so much fun, and I don't care that this album is sloppy. Tommy Lee, he can't open and close his hi-hat very well. I don't fucking care. Nobody fucking notices shit like that except drummers. And I don't know. This band is awesome. This album is awesome. Even so, I'm giving this fourth place out of five. I'm gonna be doing. We only picked four albums, but I'm gonna do a smaller review of one of the other ones. Okay. Yeah, fourth out of five. That's it.
Okay. Yeah. This CD grew on me quite a bit this week. Yeah. So they don't have those like stadium anthems yet in their writing. The CD, I think it takes some getting used to for people coming in. I've never listened to this record before. I heard some of the songs from it, but I've never listened to it. There's so many different track listings for this as well. Like, this record has been finger fucked by everybody and their mother. So what you see on, I don't know if even Wikipedia has like every combination, but yeah, there's multiple track listings for this. It's different everywhere you look. The recording quality is kind of whack on this album at points. The playing is on point, though. I think that these guys work well. And yeah, I think this is a charming record. And I think as a whole, like when we talked about Van Halen, I personally think David Lee Roth is charming. And I know a lot of people hate him for the stuff that he talks about and everything and writes about. But these guys, I think, are charming as well. And this is before like this heroin addiction era of the band that like everybody knows about. There's more cowbell on this album than you might think. So when people talk about cowbell, they bring up Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction. There's a bunch of cowbell on that album. There's a shit ton of cowbell on this record. Now, as far as Nikki Sixx goes, I think he holds down the bass fine, and I would say kind of well. There's no backing guitar, so even if they're playing with one guitar player, they could always play the backing chords. But if you listen to a song like Take Me to the Top, there's no guitar filling in under the guitar solo. It's just the bass. And I think Nikki Sixx does well. He does fine. He fills it in, and that's exactly what they would sound like live. And that's one artistic, stylistic choice that they might have taken to not record backing guitar, because it won't sound like that live anyway. Vince Neil said that this is when they were a punk band before they became a metal band. He considers this like their punk era. People say this album was recorded in the late 70s. It was not. Or at least I have no evidence supporting that. So this is recorded in like 1981, I'm pretty sure. I'm giving this number three for the week, and I do think it's charming. I think this record is I don't mean it's charming like, oh, look at this. Like, it's a big boy record. Like, I think the album is charming. I'm giving it three. I think this record is great. I listened to it a ton of times. Oh, I hear a bunch of Van Halen on here, guitar playing wise and just influence wise. Like the word Live Wire, that word is actually said in a Van Halen song, like Dance the Night Away. I don't know if that's where it's taken from, but when I'm thinking Van Halen from some guitar playing and just the era of this happening, and then I hear a word like that, it's like, okay, well, that was in a song, so I don't know if that came from there or whatever. So Tommy Lee said they went into the studio to record this and pretty much just press play and made this album. So yeah, Live Wire, like, banger of a song. I love that song. One of my favorites in their entire catalog, banger status. There's a comment on that song where someone says Tommy Lee is my favorite drummer. I don't know if I've ever heard a single person ever say that. I don't know where he ranks in the world of drumming, but I wouldn't think that a lot of people are going to say that he's their favorite. But there's another one on Public Enemy number one. There's a comment on there that says Mick and Tommy are like the Page and Bonham the driving motor. And then some guy like Jimmy Page and John Bonham from Led Zeppelin. And then some guy commented, like responded to that and said, do not ever put those four names together. Thank you. So yeah, I don't know. There's going to be people who love these guys. Like this band was huge and there's people who are going to love these guys. And there's other people who I don't know. It's because if they haven't dove into the whole thing or why they're keeping it outside. But yeah, this record is good. It's not my favorite, but I do like how different this is than the other stuff. Jomo, what do you think of this album?
You know what? This gives me solid garage band vibes. That it's like this is nostalgic, like kind of swing music feels and bluesy. That it's good at the same time, but it's like it's experimental shit, man. Because you're mixing, there's blues in there, there's fucking metal, there's hair metal, all that shit. It's just. This album is like Leather Daddy feels about to give you his sweet veiny gift, and it's all good stuff. Livewire is a strong opener that crushes. The cowbell on Come and Dance, it has no place in that song. And fuck you, Tommy Lee, for putting cowbell in Public Enemy. I just, when you brought up cowbell, like I had like a Vietnam PTSD moment where there's like helicopters flying behind me, and I'm like thousand yard stare. And I'm like, that, how dare you, Tommy Lee? And it doesn't stop. It doesn't stop because there's a cowbell through that. I think on almost every fucking album, there's something with cowbell. If I miss something, then I fucked up, whatever. But this is like listening to 50s rock on steroids, man. But it's not bad at all. It's just, it's ballsy. It's got energy. The production quality is not like some of the later albums, but... nothing but great songs. Love Take Me to the Top. That was probably one of the best bangers. It's a slay fucking song of the album. Take Me to the Top. It's just like, it's got like this jazz on it, man. And Vince Neil, man, like he's got quite the fucking range, man. He's super talented. There's a lot of great songs on here. I will say that Tommy Lee can actually... Keep Time, that is amazing. Unlike Lars Ulrich, I would say this is a 7 for 10 for the week for me. Not bad.
I don't know if Vince Neil uses, like, I want to know what his range is, because when I hear Michael Starr, and obviously like Steel Panther is a takeoff, and I don't want to, like, almost like a parody of Motley Crue. They really are, and he has a crazy range, and I'm gonna bring it up when I hear it, but I don't really hear him hitting those David Lee Roth, like, I don't know, falsetto, whatever the fuck the notes are called, those really high notes. He does do it. I don't know if he does it on this record. He does do it every now and then, but he doesn't hit it as much as you might think. So a couple of things I want to say. Oh, so yeah, Mick Mars, right? He does some really cool things with harmonics. Take Me to the Top has this great guitar riff with harmonics in it. He does some stuff later on with it. On this record, he's never like my favorite guitar player of all time. He's never going to be, but he hits like he transcends at some point, and it hasn't come yet for him. The song Too Fast for Love has gang vocals on it, which I think do so much for it. And there's a comment on that song on YouTube, and someone says, this song is absolutely atrocious. And then someone responded and said, then I want sloppy seconds. So nice. Yeah. So some people want the gross, nitty, you know, gritty stuff, and some people just aren't about it. Starry Eyes is actually a cool combination of ideas. You have like this heavy music and almost like a ballady chorus. We'll get to the big, huge power ballad by this band later on. But again, this album, they're kind of like, you can see all the everything starting to sprout here, where Motley Crue becomes later on like what they really are as a band, and this is like a good starting off point, because there's a billion fucking ideas going on in this album. Is there anything else anyone wants to say about this before I read some YouTube comments?
Tommy Lee is good, but like when people told me he's the best drummer ever because he has a giant drum set and two bass drums and fucking cowbells and shit, I'm just like, you know, that sounds like overcompensation to me. That was the fucking meme I always heard. It's like, the bigger the drum set it is, like, the smaller your dick is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, I saw the sex tape, so no, that's not
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I saw it just because it was brought up during the episode. I was on his Wikipedia, and it was like they talked about the Pam and Tommy Lee sex tape. I was like, I forgot about that. Yeah, she's got some curtain hangers, and he's got a Greek little god down there, man. He's got a hammer.
What do you, by curtain hangers, you mean like RBC?
Oh yeah, she's got. What does that mean? She's got some fucking some extra meat on the taco.
Okay. All right. Let's read some YouTube comments. First one, Mick kills it in the solo for Merry-Go-Round. Next one says that rare perfect chemistry. If Vince, Nikki, Mick, or Tommy were missing, it wouldn't be the same. Yeah, these guys seem really close, and that's why I'm surprised they continuously wanted to kick out Mick Mars. Next one says, most bands are lucky if they make one solid album. Crew definitely ruled the 80s. Next one says, this is one raw record. And lastly, I grew up listening to this. I remember crying when I heard Vince Neil was out of the band. I thought it was over. That was Jomo's comment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Nice. Is there anything else anyone wants to say about Too Fast for Love?
Next.
Yeah, it's a fun record. Okay, let me drop this artwork. Jomo, what do you think of this artwork?
Oh boy.
Is that Edgelord or what?
I saw there was a different one. There was a
yeah, right. This was the original one. Eventually people flipped the fuck out and they had to remove the pentagram.
Put the other one
on. All right, hang on.
I love the other one though, because this looks like something Dimmu Borgir would put out. Like it's like, all right, cool, that's edgy, bro. You got a pentagram, yeah. Whatever. Shout at the Devil though. Oh my god. What a motherfucking album. But we need the other album artwork because
I'm getting it. Come on.
I literally had gay thoughts while like looking at it, bro. Like my you know how your dick unravels, like you know, if you're like putting air in something and it's like a plastic thing and it starts to unravel. That's what
this picture's huge. Penis. I don't
put in there.
I don't care. I'm done. All right, there we go. Oh, that man. One.
Yeah. look at Mick Mars. It's Jesus Christ.
I know. Yeah, he looks like your creepy uncle.
He looks like he looks like he's having he's trying to take a shit, man. <He's
wrong. laughs> Someone he was like in the bathroom, someone just threw the stall door open and took a picture of him and he was like still in the middle of taking a shit.
Vince looks a little bit like Britney, don't you think? Yeah. Like the cheekbones.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cheekbones are a dead giveaway. Yeah.
This is before he gained like a whole other person to his weight.
Yeah, he chubbed up at one point.
Oh, man. Yeah, but if you tell me Tommy Lee and Nikki Sixx, they could get fucked. I'm not gay, but that's all I'm saying, you know?
Oh, like you'd fuck them, yeah.
Yeah, bareback too. I don't give a shit.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you can't have a kid, so.
Yeah.
Which is the worst STD.
All right.
Ready?
Yeah.
All
right. Shout at the devil as an 11-track record released in 1983, coming in just under 35 minutes long. It's the band's second studio album, reaching number 17 on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart, and contains the singles "Looks That Kill," "Helter Skelter," and "Too Young to Fall in Love." Shout at the Devil was the band's breakthrough album, selling 200,000 copies in its first 2 weeks, establishing Motley Crue as one of the top-selling heavy metal acts of the 1980s. Its title and the band's use of a pentagram caused a great deal of controversy upon its 1983 release, as Christian and conservative groups claimed the band was encouraging their listeners to worship Satan. The pentagram was something Nikki Sixx brought with him from Sister, a very theatrical band he had been a member of in the late 1970s prior to the formation of Motley Crue. Just prior to returning home to Los Angeles to begin recording, Motley Crue was famously kicked off their support spot on Kiss's Creatures of the Night tour. They played only 5 shows together before Gene Simmons demanded they be replaced, citing their bad behavior. During recording, Nikki Sixx was involved in a serious car crash after drunkenly stealing a friend's Porsche in Los Angeles. At around the same time, actress and friend Demi Moore told Sixx he needed Alcoholics Anonymous, though he dismissed her concerns. Sixx badly injured his shoulder in the crash and was prescribed Percocet, which was commonly prescribed to treat severe short-term pain. Sixx's use of it transitioned directly to a crippling addiction to heroin, which would cost him $3,500 a day and almost kill him later in the decade. As the band toured with Ozzy Osbourne in support of Shout at the Devil, they discussed replacing guitarist Mick Mars. Mars was several years older than the other members of the band, and his bandmates were eager to add a more technically proficient guitarist. As the tour continued, the band was invited to take part in the 1984 Monsters of Rock Festival, supporting headliners Van Halen and AC/DC. Guitarist Eddie Van Halen was bitten by Vince Neil during a dinner, with drummer Tommy Lee also biting Malcolm Young at the same point. Van Halen and Young were reportedly furious over this behavior. Lee also became involved in a fist fight with David Lee Roth, which saw Motley Crue expelled from their hotel. AC/DC and Van Halen both subsequently demanded Motley Crue be removed from the bill, but the band's popularity at the time made such a move difficult. The promoter came up with an unusual situation. Motley Crue would enter their trailer immediately upon arrival at the concert venue, and a large crane would then lift the trailer several meters off the ground to prevent the band members from leaving and causing trouble prior to their performance. They would also be required to leave the concert venue immediately following their performance. Shout at the Devil features a cover of the Beatles' 1968 song Helter Skelter, a song that allegedly inspired cult leader Charles Manson. Six was not a Beatles fan, referring to the band as fucking wimpy, but he lists Helter Helter Skelter and the White Album among his favorites of all time. Shout at the Devil has been certified 4 times platinum. Jomo, what do you think of Shout at the Devil?
Yo. First of all, I want to go back to this fucking album artwork that made me gay. Holy shit. Like, I've never seen the only unfuckable person in there is fucking Mick Mars.
He's unfuckable. I agree. He's unfuckable.
Mick Mars looks like someone's alcoholic aunt who's like talking about her Riesling and how it's not tardy enough. But dude, it's just uncomfortable to look at. But Shout at the Devil, bro, that's an iconic, very ballsy song, man. Like, to put out there, it's just like, you know, it's fucking Motley Crue. You know, you're getting into some shit, man. Looks That Kill is for sure a stripper song, bro. I like anything. So first time going to a strip club, I fucking heard Looks That Kill, and this girl was dancing. She was definitely a D-lister. I could see her C-section scar. It was pretty bad. But I just, anytime I listen to fucking Motley Crue, it's always in reference to like fucking strippers, man. It is what it is. And I love that new, like Vince Neil, he could slay those fucking high notes, bro. Like, he goes for them ballsy, even if at points where it just like it fizzles out and it's not completely what you want it to be. He's giving his all, man. So you appreciate the fucking hard work and effort he puts into. But now he looks like Jabba the Hutt struggling to breathe. It's like, if you see current fucking Vince Neil, it's just like, it's not good, bro. It's like, put down the Trudos, bro. It's like, you're done eating those. And to me, this album is heavier than Too Fast for Love. There's no bullshit in it. I would say 7.7, obviously, for the week. For me, it's a solid work. These dudes all look like power bottoms, though, for some odd reason.
Vince Neil said that Motley Crue has been inducted into the Stripper Hall of Fame. I don't know if that's an actual thing.
Yeah, I hope so.
Nice.
But if it is, they're in there. Yeah, so they do a bunch of stuff with motorcycles. I believe Nikki Sixx got his ass beat by a bunch of people in the Hell's Angels at one point. And then, yeah, Jesus so they Christ. They would hang out like every day. That like the strip club was like their headquarters. They like lived there. So I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but I'm trying to remember when I first, like, this Shout at the Devil is either the first or second record that I ever owned. When I was younger, I used to go with my dad to yard sales all the time, and I would find like records and buy some. And the first two I ever bought was Kiss Destroyer and Shout at the Devil. And I used to listen to this record all the time. I love this album. I'm giving it number one for the week. A lot of that is probably due to dorky me listening to it all the time when I was younger. So they're writing these big arena rock songs now. They might not be as big as they become, but like they're big. There's a lot of arena they're a metal band here, but you know what I mean? Like the arena rock songs where there's people who can sing along and everything. I think the flow of this album is fucking perfect. And the transition from, yeah. So you said this album is heavier than Too Fast for Love. And it is, their transition though, from that to this is like pretty impressive to see, these guys leaned like completely into it. And I think they did a really good job with it. There's a song on here called Bastard, which is a crime against humanity. In my opinion, that it wasn't a single, it single-handedly makes me want to join like a Motley Crue cover band. I'm giving it banger status. And the funny thing about the song Bastard, you remember bitch ass Tipper Gore?
Yeah. Sure. Oh, that cunt.
Yeah, the cunt, yeah. Well, she had something called her Filthy 15 list, and it was like 15 songs or bands that she considered like filthy. Number one is Prince, which is fucking hilarious. Anyway, the song Bastard is on there, and so Vince Neil was... it gets put on this list, I guess, and they bitch about it, and then the moms of America get fucking... Mothers of America get pissed off or whatever whenever they hear it. But Vince Neil was like said later, he's like, you know, once you put a sticker on it, this parental advisory thing... The kids want it even more. So like it works against what you're trying to do. Shout at the Devil. That I would have loved for that song to have been a single. So yeah, this, when this record came out, the pentagram was the album artwork and it released like that. So it wasn't like, if you look at Far Beyond Driven by Pantera, there are two artworks. One of them is the drill going into a skull and the other one is a drill going into someone's asshole. Mm. And I don't know if the asshole one was ever actually officially released. And they really, then they, and if it was, it was very like limitedly released. And then they released the skull one. But later on, when it had the anniversary for that record, they went back and put the original artwork out. This one released with the fucking pentagram. And then apparently people bitched about it. So they changed it to the cover art that makes Jomo gay. But it's like, you know, if these guys had doubled down and made Shout at the Devil a single, like, I'm pretty sure like the Mothers of America would have actually like had a heart attack and fucking died. That song has to be amazing live. It's fucking classic Motley Crue. And then song Looks That Kill. Like, that's no brainer single, right? It's one of the biggest bangers off the records. Catchy as hell. Gets stuck in your head immediately. And yeah, so there's parts where I'm like, Mick Mars is not my favorite guitar player. I mean, he's never going to be like my like top five. But like there's parts where I, times when I love him and the times where I'm like, eh, whatever. And on like Looks That Kill, I love everything that he does in the song. I think he's fucking awesome. There's a comment on that song on YouTube where it says, where did we end up like with songs like this? Where do we end up with music nowadays? I don't think music nowadays is really that bitch personally. Like, I think maybe the stuff that you'd hear on the radio is, but there's tons of like really great, really heavy shit. The fact that Lamb of God exists and gets radio play and is as heavy as they are, as heavy and good as they are, they're carrying a bunch of that on their back. Rob, what do you think of this record?
I fucking love this album. I'm giving it number one also. Okay, to back up a little bit, this thing where they keep wanting to kick Mick Mars out of the band, I think that's fucking not fair. Okay, so you take Van Halen. It's like the bass player is like playing the simplest fucking shit. But you kind of need somebody playing simple ass shit if you have Van Halen in the band. Van Halen, you know, so many people will say Van Halen is like the best of all time. Or if he isn't, then he's like, as far as pop music goes, he has to be like top, you know, whatever. Like there's people who are faster, there's people who are more virtuoso, but somebody who writes songs that are that tuneful, that like catchy, that pop, and being that progressive, like Van Halen's like top there. So, you know, Mick Mars isn't there, but I feel like it's fucking not fair to like say he's not Van Halen, so we have to kick him out. Fucking nobody's Van Halen. Like, you can't, I don't know. Like, but yeah, like back to guitar playing. We've been circling around this idea of like the bluesiness of this band. Yeah, there are times when this band is like fucking boomer, like But ultimately, I decided this is a good thing. Like, my comfort zone is minor, like of fucking what's that band I've been talking about all the time? Fuck, I forgot the name of it. But anyways, yeah, Judas Priest. Yeah, like my comfort zone is all fucking minor, like dark shit. But this band is like bluesy. There's the like between the chords and the scales, and there's all kinds of chromatics and. It's not all good chromatics. Some I'm going to talk about riffs on pretty much every album. Some of the like chromatics don't work for me. This isn't a fucking melody. This isn't and some of it really does work for me. It's not my favorite necessarily, but to me, like, this week has been a breath of fresh air, because this isn't the shit I listen to all the time. This is something else, and I don't know, it brought life to my life. This is a fucking fun week for me. Yeah, so I'm giving this number one for the week, not because it has the smash hit singles that the other ones have. I'm gonna talk about like some of these songs are like, some of these songs that this band made are like my favorite fucking pop songs like of all time. This album doesn't have the hits, but I think it's pretty fucking good from beginning to end. And that means more to me. An album that you put on and you listen to and you don't need to fucking press skip. There are so few albums like that. And I think this is one of them. I shout out to Devil. Good fucking song. I know that song from fucking rock Band or Guitar Hero or some shit. Looks That Kill has like one of those like verses with a chromatic riff that like isn't really a melody, but the chorus is a chromatic riff that's badass. And In the documentary that I watched, the VH1 Behind the Music or whatever, like they were saying how that's a fucking like actually marketable song that proved the record execs wrong. Okay, so one thing about like music, if you aren't pissing off the previous generation, you probably aren't pushing shit hard enough. You know, they were on this fucking record label that had like every like quiet like nice guy fucking a band on it, so the record execs like, what the fuck is Motley Crue doing on here, a bunch of fucking punk kids like dressing like women and fucking, you know, there's nothing marketable about this. Good for them for just like, I believe what they did is they just kept touring, and eventually it was like, people love this music, it actually makes money. And I feel weird even like saying that money comes into it. I mean, it does and it doesn't. I don't know. I fucking love this band. Anyways, yeah, Bastard, I love this song. I love that song as much as you do, Jack. Yeah, there's some boomeriness to the key changes, but I don't like Jomo was saying, there's this old-timey feel to it, but like now you got some like double bass, you got some energy. We know bands with more double bass and faster double bass, but this is pop double bass. There's nothing like, how many albums, I don't know. Like I just remember being told back 20 years ago, I remember being told you can't get double bass on the radio, but fucking, I don't know. Motley Crue made so many fucking pop hits that had double bass in them. Bastards one, Red Hot's another one. God Bless to the Children of the Beast. Okay, that song's fucking funny, first of all, because it misleads you, like and there's the misdirection at the end there. But yeah, that's another song there that I'm like, I'm listening to it, and I'm like, okay, you know, cool riffs, and then there's like a harmonized solo. Remember that this is 84, so it's not like today where you can have garage band presets where it's like, okay, you have your one guitar and then you just press like the auto harmonize button. This isn't like that. This dude did all of the guitar parts, so it seems to me that he knows his theory and he knows his whatever. I'm listening to it before I knew this is one guitar player. I'm like, this is either one guitar player or this is like a remarkably tight band, you know. For you to harmonize with a solo like that, it's not fucking easy. But yeah, it's one guitar player. He does a good job. God Bless the Children of the Beast. Yeah, I was wondering to myself how much pop music makes those Satan jokes. Like I know that Merciful Fate was making like Satan jokes, or I don't know if they're jokes or not, but he was doing it in 81. But I don't know how many pop bands were doing. Slayer's Reign in Blood was 86, right? And I don't think Slayer's Reign in Blood was as popular as this album was. But anyways, yeah, I and then we talked about the satanic fucking album artwork there. Yeah, I wasn't quite sure whether all that shit was underground or not, but you know, this band was this band was doing shit that I didn't think that pop bands did. Yeah, too young to fall in love. Fucking love that song too. Yeah, I'm giving this number one. This album's fucking good, beginning to end. That's it. But
okay, so when I was saying that these guys like really leaned into it, right? They went full into this record. So God Bless the Children of the Beast. Okay, when I'm listening to that, that is a song that I would not expect Motley Crue or anybody to really do unless they had gone full into this idea of like Shout at the Devil. What I was going to say is I would expect that from Merciful Fate. I would not expect that from Motley Crue, but I love it. It makes me love Mick Mars even more. And it gives the record some breathing room. And it's like, it's not a bitch song, right? It's metal as fuck. I love it. This has the cover of Helter Skelter, and with the amount of bands or people who shit on bands for covering the Beatles, I'm surprised how supportive people are of Helter Skelter. And so I hope that Motley Crue covering the Beatles pissed off even more mothers of America who were like listening to it. I like these guys are part of this is they're into it, and part of it is they're definitely poking and trolling. They 100% are. They're trying to push it. They're trying to be annoying. And I love that. Like, I want them to do that. And back when I was listening to this, I probably didn't even notice that it was a cover for two things. I didn't listen to the Beatles back in the day. I mean, I still don't. And it fits in really well on this album. This record flows well. Too Young to Fall in Love has to be one of their most famous songs. Classic Motley Crue. Knock 'Em Dead Kid is another fucking great arena song. Red Hot is another one you brought up. I love that song. Yeah, this record's not boring. It's awesome still. It sounds good. It flows well. Yeah, it's a great record. Let's read a couple YouTube comments. First one, masterpiece, immortal, God bless Motley Crue. Next person says, Mick Mars was totally different than anyone on guitar. Next comment, 40 years later, it still sounds killer. Next one says, could listen to this album every single day. And lastly, the spoken intro is epic. Yeah, this does have a good intro to it. It's called In the Beginning, and it's good as well. So yeah, you can't really go wrong with it. Is there anything else anyone wants to say about Shout Out the Devil?
No.
Okay. Does anyone need to use the bathroom?
Why are you
gay? Yep. Maybe next time.
Okay. All righty. We ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay. Theater of Pain is a 10-track record released in 1985, coming in just over 35 minutes long. It's the band's third studio album, reaching number 6 on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart, and contains the singles Smokin' in the Boys Room, Home Sweet Home, and Keep Your Eye on the Money. Released in the aftermath of Vince Neil's arrest for manslaughter on a drunk driving charge, the album marked the beginning of the band's transition away from the traditional heavy metal sound of Too Fast for Love and Shout at the Devil towards a more glam metal style. In early 1985, Motley Crue entered the studio to begin recording the follow-up to the highly successful Shout at the Devil. The band had enjoyed a tumultuous 2 years in the wake of Shout at the Devil's unexpected success. Their fondness for partying and sex earned them a reputation as a legitimately dangerous band, culminating in a December 8th, 1984 car crash, which killed Hanoi Rocks drummer Razzle and saw Vince Neil facing possible prison time for vehicular manslaughter. On top of Neil's troubles, the band's founder and primary songwriter, Nikki Sixx, had developed a heroin addiction, which was beginning to spiral out of control. Further adding to the turmoil, the band had been seriously considering replacing guitarist Mick Mars. It was these uncertainties hanging over them that Theater of Pain's recording commenced in January 1985. During recording, the album's working title was Entertainment or Death, though Sixx changed it prior to the release. Theater of Pain enjoyed tremendous success upon its release in the early summer of 1985. The singles Smokin' in the Boys Room and Home Sweet Home, both of which remain staples of the band's live sets for decades to come, helped the album reach the quadruple platinum status of its predecessor, Shout at the Devil. The album was dedicated to the memory of Razzle. Despite the success, the opinions of the band members themselves in regards to Theater of Pain have been decidedly negative in the ensuing years. Vince Neil has referred to Theater of Pain as his least favorite Motley Crue album, and Nikki Sixx has referred to it as a pile of rubbish, the whole fucking record, with a few moments of maybe brilliance. Mick Mars said in 1985 that it was more polished than their previous releases, adding that the references to sex and violence were not as blatant on Theater of Pain. Theater of Pain has been certified 4 times platinum and features a cover of Brownsville Station's 1973 hit Smokin' in the Boys Room. I'm giving this number 4 for the week, personally. There's some parts of this record that I love, and there's some parts that I kind of hate. And even if some of the stuff we had listened before or after this, like, wasn't top 10 for me, I didn't really hate any of it. It just didn't land in the upper echelon for me. Also, this album feels dated to me, unlike the other ones. There are a bunch of songs on here that are just so 80s, and it's not that that's a bad thing, but none of the other ones, even though there's very 80s things going on, like when I was listening to this, some of these songs on my way, home last night with Becca, some of them I was just like, yo, that just sounds so 80s. And so there are things here that, like, Keep Your Eye on the Money, like that song is just like 80s as hell. And it's a bit too slow. It needs to be picked up beats per minute. And it also reminds me of Looks That Kill from Shout Out the Devil. But so, like, one of the letdowns for me on this album is Smokin' in the Boys Room, because I love that song. And I thought it was an original. So I was, like, proud of them for making something like that. And then when I saw it was a cover, I was like, oh, okay. Well, it kind of takes away a little bit for me because I thought it was, like, a really cool thing that they had made, and it sounded so much different than all the other stuff that they were doing. It's still a great song, and I still love it, but it did take away a bit for me finding out that they didn't actually, like, write the song. And then you have Home Sweet Home, right? And I don't care if people will say it's boring or played out, because I know, like, there's going to be some people who are like, yeah, that song is lame, and there's some people who are going to love it. I'm going to say it's banger status. I love that song. So Motley Crue has said, specifically Vince Neil, that they created the power ballad. And that could be true. It probably depends on who you ask. If you ask some people, they'll probably tell you that the Beatles created the power ballad. But This record deserves to exist for this song alone, Home Sweet Home. Like, I fucking love the song. I can listen to it forever. And yeah, so I'm giving it 4. I just think I like the other ones more than Theater of Pain. Rob, what do you think of this record?
I'm giving it 5 out of 5. I think it's the band is pretty self-aware here. I'm like, I'm going to echo some of the stuff they said. This record, like the production of it, like, okay, I think I listened to the first album first, and then I listened to this one, and I'm like, oh, is this the same fucking singer? Like, it sounds like he like took voice lessons, and like, it doesn't sound like the same guy at all. Like, this guy seems like professional and whatever. Other than that, I didn't connect with this album. I like fucking like some, I'm passionate about at least something on all of these albums except for this one. I mean, the only thing I have to say is Smoking the Boys Room is lame instrumentally and lyrically. I mean, if the last album is fucking like Satan and God Bless the Children of the Beast, this is like Smoking Ain't Allowed in School. It's like you guys fucking became lame. Fuck you, Fifth Place. That's it.
Nice. Yeah, like some of the mid songs on here, right? So like Fight for Your Rights, which is the last song, like I know there's gonna be people who love that song, but I don't give two shits about that song. City Boy Blues starts this record. This song is like poster child for like a song that is mid. It's like, it's not bad, it's not great, it's like straight up in the mid category where like I could see most people not even caring about it. Yeah. When Vince Neil was talking about this record, like the person who fucking made it, he said, besides Smoking in the Boys Room and Home Sweet Home, I think he said, I don't even remember any of the other songs on that record. and it's not surprising. There's a bunch of stuff here that's mid. Now, there are people who do love this record. We're going to see like in the YouTube comments that people are probably going to say it's their favorite of the Motley Crue releases. But like when I hear like City Boy Blues, I'm like, I wonder if there's anyone out there who wants to hear this when they go to a Motley Crue concert. And then I remember that someone somewhere loves fucking Chinese Democracy. So someone is like, oh my God, I'm going to see Motley Crue tonight. I hope they play City Boy Blues. And they probably aren't going to. Jomo, what do you think of this record?
The album artwork looks like shit. So the first thing, starting off with the aesthetics on that. But the music's, I guess, kind of decent. City Boy Blues and Smoking the Boys Room, you guys fucking talked about, to me, bluesy vibes. But it also complements Tommy Lee well, because he's got rudimentary drumming, so those are easy songs to play. Home Sweet Home is a motherfucking ballad, and it rocks my balls for sure. It makes my balls like quiver, and I'm just like, oh boy, like I get that tingling feeling. I don't know if it's athlete's foot or something, but you know, something about it, man, it gets you going. Use a Loser, I thought was a fucking banger. Makes me want to jerk off like right on the spot just to make sure my shit is still good. I think Fight for Your Rights is a call to action. Just saying, I don't want to be on the FBI's list. I'm just saying, okay? But this album didn't do it for me the same way that Shout at the Devil did for me, man. So I would say fucking 4 out of 10 for me for the week.
So the song Use It or Lose It, right? Musically, I love that song. Lyrically, I think I hate it. It sounds like Vince Neil like heard that guitar riff and they said, okay, write something to this. And he wrote like some dumb shit to follow it. There's a line in the 40-Year-Old Virgin, I had to go find it, where he's taking one of the girls to like the Planned Parenthood, and he's like, yo, is it true if you don't use it, you lose it? Because I'm like, yeah, what the fuck does that mean, and what does this song mean? Anyway, the song is about like using time wisely. I had to look it up, but yeah, I don't know. It's like musically the song is good, lyrically I'm like, the song's fucking lame. Louder Than Hell, that's a song that actually shows Vince Neil like hitting some pretty high notes. So he doesn't do those like really David Lee Roth high notes or Michael Starr high notes too often, but he does do them there. He is capable of doing them. It's a good song. I think Louder Than Hell should have been a single on this record. And then there's a song, Tonight, We Need a Lover. I love that song. I think it's awesome. It's another one that was stuck in my head for a while. And that's another one that's like very 80s. People say it sounds like very 80s. And people say that it's underrated and it doesn't ever get played at shows. I agree that it's underrated. I think it's a standout from this record. But yeah, as a whole, I'm going to put this dead last. Let's read a couple YouTube comments. First one, the first 4 albums are so different from each other. That's what makes them great. Next one says, high school cruising tunes. Next comment, really puts me back in my bedroom listening to this and my walls covered in Crue posters. Next comment, that sounded way This sounded way more hair metal, but in a really charming way. And lastly, possibly the most underrated Crew album, it's a gem of sleazy glam blues metal rock. So there you go. Anything else anyone wants to say about Theater of Pain? All right, let's push through. Let's push through.
Sure, I got to take a piss.
Oh, okay. Let's hit the bathroom. Let's take five.
All right, take five.
Okay.
Classy.
What's up, Jemma?
Yo, did you get that prenup, baby? What's going on?
No, I didn't get the prenup.
What? Stupid! my God. At least consider a post-note. What's with you? I'm trying to help you.
I know you are. Yo, that sounded crisp as fuck.
It is. Were you drinking Lequan? Or Polar?
Yeah, it's Polar. Yo, Jomo, I heard you love Bob Rock.
No, I fucking hate Bob Rock. That dude is, that dude is fucking ass cancer, dude. Fuck him.
He's the equivalent of ass cancer.
If it could be personified, it'd be fucking Bob Rock.
You go to a medical dictionary, it says ass cancer, and there's a picture of Bob Rock's face. Rob, did you want to talk about Girls, Girls, Girls? Is that what you want to talk about?
Girls,
which record did you want to talk about?
Yeah, the thing that I wanted to say is Wildside might be my favorite fucking song by this band, or it's like, you know, it's top three. And I think that's all I really wanted to say is like, and if you like, so I'm giving it third place just because fucking I cannot say how much I love that song. I don't care how lame that makes me. It's a fucking 10 out of 10 song.
Mm. Yeah, I love that song. Yeah, and Girls, Girls, Girls. That song's a banger too.
Why are you gay?
Yo, these guys are in the Stripper Hall of Fame. I don't even think, are they in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
No, I doubt it.
Fuck the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They're in the Stripper Hall of Fame.
It took them forever to fucking induct Rush, so go fuck themselves.
Let's be real. Do you want to sit next to Keith Richards, or do you want to sit next to a chick with big ass titties that are about to be put in your face?
Dude, I'm trying to get a divorce. No, I'm just joking. No, you know.
All right.
Yeah, I'm gonna, what's up? No, I'm done. I'm getting canceled.
Okay. Ass cancer. Dr. Feelgood is an 11-track record released in 1989, coming in just over 45 minutes long. It's the band's fifth studio album, reaching number one on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart. It contains the singles Dr. Feelgood, Kickstart My Heart, Without You, Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away, and Same Old Situation. Dr. Feelgood topped the Billboard 200 chart, making it the band's only album to do so. It was the first album Motley Crue recorded after their quest for sobriety and rehabilitation in 1989. In addition to being the Crue's best-selling album, it is highly regarded by music critics and fans as their best studio album. It was also their last to be recorded with Vince Neil until 1997's Generation Swine. Producer Bob Rock found working with Motley Crue difficult, describing them as four L.A. badasses who used to drink a bottle of wine and want to kill each other. To minimize conflict and allow production to proceed smoothly, Rock had each member record their parts separately. The intro track, TNT, Terror in Tinseltown, features a sample of a woman saying, "Dr. Davis, telephone, please." This was the same sample used by the band Queensryche for their song Eyes of a Stranger, which was off their album Operation Mindcrime, released 1 year prior to Dr. Feelgood. The end of Slice of Your Pie is based on She's So Heavy from the Beatles' 1969 album Abbey Road. Steven Tyler of Aerosmith sings backing vocals on Sticky Sweet, with Tyler saying, "Nikki and Tommy and I hung out a lot. Of course, we were all akin by our old drinking and drugging days." Metallica drummer Lars Ulrich recruited Bob Rock to produce their self-titled 1991 album after being impressed with Rock's production work on Dr. Feelgood. Rock would later produce Metallica's subsequent albums Until Saint Anger, where he also played its bass parts. To mark the 20th anniversary of Dr. Feelgood, Motley Crue performed it in its entirety at Crue Fest 2. At 1989's 32nd Annual Grammy Awards, Dr. Feelgood was nominated for Best Hard Rock Performance but lost to Living Color with Cult of Personality. What? At 1990's 33rd Annual Grammy Awards, Kickstart My Heart was nominated for Best Rock Performance but lost to Living Color with Time's Up. Double whammy there. Dr. Feelgood has been certified 6 times platinum. Rob, what do you think of Dr. Feelgood?
I love it. Giving it second place for the week. Okay, so the song Dr. Feelgood feels weird and boomery to me. I cringe, I guess. whatever. It's a super popular song, but it's not for me. Kickstart My Heart was another song on that mix that girl made for me. I fucking love that song. It's fucking 10 out of 10. It's top tier fucking pop. It has like chromatics that work. It has the vocals, the fucking, I fucking love that song. Top tier pop. Same old situation. Same fucking thing I just said. Chromatics that work. And I don't know how many like music theory people have told me, but like normal scale stuff makes fucking sense. Chromatics, like if you can make it work, like there's no fucking rule to make it work other than maybe like some blues scale stuff that have been done so many times. But I don't know, like chromatic stuff that works. Motley Crue has a lot of it. You get some in the same old situation. Fucking yeah. And then like, yeah. So you got weird guitar shit that shouldn't work but does, and then you got like choruses that are just fucking candy. It's just like, oh my god, I feel like this should be beneath me, but it isn't. It's like this is when I think of pop that I fucking love, like fucking give me this. I don't know, and I don't know. Like, yeah, so in general, I don't think this song is as beginning to end good as Shout Out the Devil. There's fucking, there's ballads on this song, like, on this album, and, like, those are moneymakers in this decade. I don't give a fuck about them. I could go without them, but, you know, whatever. If they did this and this, whatever. That's their fucking thing. It made sense at the time, or I don't fucking know. Anyways, it's not for me. So maybe there's only two songs on this album that I'm really fucking passionate about. Maybe a couple others that are pretty good. But anyways, still gets second place for me. Fucking top tier pop. That's it.
Yeah, I'm giving it number two as well. I think that this is a good record. It's created during sobriety, and it shows. So Rust in Peace and Dr. Feelgood are examples of what bands can accomplish when, you know, you ditch the hard drugs. So there's going to be people who say, like, oh, you have to do drugs to make music. They're talking about, like, LSD and marijuana. They're not talking about fucking heroin. Well, the people, it depends. Unless they're talking about jazz, then they're talking about heroin. So Mick Mars, to me, he finally transcends, right? I love him more than ever on this record. Bob Rock can fuck off, but the recording quality of this album is fucking really, really good. Now, obviously, he didn't fucking create the actual microphones and stuff, but he was in charge of putting this together, and he did a good job with it. He can still go fuck himself, though. Artwork needs more pentagrams. There's none on there. So this starts off, Terror in Tinseltown is like this minute-long intro where pretty much Nikki Sixx or whoever the main character is supposed to be. I don't think this is a concept album, but whoever the main character is like dies on the way to the hospital of a drug overdose. And the way it's done, it's my favorite of the intros. Like I believe like the last three, oh no, sorry, Theater of Pain didn't have an intro, but Shout Out the Devil did. And I think it sets this like record up perfectly. So Dr. Feelgood, Rob says like boomery. Yeah, I kind of agree. It's definitely classic Motley Crue. I will give them that. There are people who are going to like worship that song. It's not my favorite, but it's one of those songs like that everybody knows immediately, like when it comes on. I'm still going to say it's a banger, no question about that. But yeah, I'm not in love with it, but we all know we've heard it a billion times or whatever. Now, Kickstart My Heart. Not only the greatest song by Motley Crue, very possibly the greatest song ever written by anybody on planet Earth. I'm awarding it eternal banger status. Mick Mars becomes my hero in this song. It's very possibly the best he's ever played. There's some solos previous before this where he will, like, half of it will kind of be stuttery. Like maybe he could have just done another take, but then like the second half will be flawless. I think his playing in this song altogether is like flawless. The song will never die, and it deserves to live forever. Fucking perfect. I don't know. I'm obsessed with it. I don't care. I'm jerking off to it tonight. As soon as we're done with the show, I'm jerking off thinking about it. The other single on this album, Same Old Situation. I actually forgot about that song. And when I heard it, when it came in the mix, I forgot that I was like, oh, I remember the song. But I had forgotten that it was like by Motley Crue. I figured it was by one of the other ballady style bands of the 80s. And one of the things that these guys do well is they write riffs that you recognize immediately. Rob brought up Wild Side and Girls, Girls, Girls. Go play either of those songs and you will know the song in 1 second from the riff. It's instantly recognizable and they do a good job with that. Same Old Situation is a good song. I give it a pass. It could be Boomery. I don't know. I'm saying that it's good. There's a song on here called Without You that the recording quality of the song is like incredible. That's what I'm saying. Like Bob Rock, at least he did a good job with this. But like the song I don't really care about. It's like a power ballad that kind of sucks balls compared to Home Sweet Home. But the recording quality is like really fucking good. Jomo, what do you think of this album?
Dude, this is my absolute favorite Motley Crue fucking album of all time. Dr. Feelgood is such an amazing song. I was just like, bro, let me hang out with Nikki Sixx. Let's ride the lightning. We're going to gack up three lines and then we're going to ride the rail of heroin. Like I'm down for it, man. It's everything about this fucking whole album, dude, is like my go-to stripper album. It's got Girls with Daddy Issues. It's got everything. It's got Sadness. I See No Difference. Those bitches are all the same. Dude, there's nothing but great fucking songs, in this album, man. And this is coming from a Hispanic guy. My inner white trash came out when I heard Same Old Situation. Like I was singing like I was singing a fucking Neil Diamond song, man. Like it was just amazing, bro. This is the best Motley Crue album that I've ever heard my whole life. They brought their fucking A game to this. 9 out of 10, my top number one for this week.
Nice.
I'm gonna put my finger up my ass now.
Yeah, no, it is a good record. There's a song on here called Sticky Sweet that sounds to me like it's actually a Steel Panther song. But it is catchy as hell. Another hit on here was called Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away. I don't know if I would have chose that as a single, but I'm cool with it being one. Hopefully they, you know, it did well for them and they made money on it. And there's a song called Slice of Your Pie, which is one of those songs that I don't think I've ever heard a single person ever mention it. There's this actually cool blues piece maybe halfway through. You know, that's from Mick Mars. When Mick Mars was born in 1851, blues was coming around. So he's the one who's injected the blues into this band since they started. But yeah, Slice of Your Pie, you can hear the blues stuff. It's cool. But yeah, this record's good. It's not my top, but again, Kickstart My Heart. I'm thinking about it right now, and I'm hard. I just went from 6 to midnight.
Oh, yeah.
Is there anything else that anyone wants to say about Dr. Feelgood before we read some YouTube comments and we get out of here? Okay, first one. Love It. It's my second favorite Crue album. Too Fast for Love has always been my favorite. Next one says, the history behind Dr. Feelgood says that it should never have happened. Rock on, everyone. Oh, yeah. So Nikki Sixx said that when he wrote like Kickstart My Heart, he wasn't going to show it to anybody. Then like someone, one of his managers came to his house, saw it like written down, asked him what it was, told him he had to show it to the band. And then, so yeah, there's a bunch of stuff here. Oh, and then like they wanted... The record company wanted Kickstart My Heart to be the lead single and the band wanted Dr. Feelgood to be the lead single. So yeah, Kickstart My Heart was like, there's like multiple times where it should have shown through and like been like this thing to like pave the way. And it never was until like it was released as the second single. Next one, Kickstart My Heart is one of the best rock and roll masterpieces ever. Next one, back when rock and roll was trashy, raunchy, dirty, exhilarating, and badass. And I love it. And lastly, Bob Rock made them sound huge. Yeah, this record does sound huge. So we talked about four records today with Rob talking about two songs from Girls, Girls, Girls that came out in 1987. They had a self-titled album in 1984, which is the only Motley Crue record with a different singer. I can't remember who it was. Vince Neil came back for 1997's Generation Swine. In 2000, they had a CD called New Tattoo. And lastly, they had an album in 2008 called Saints of Los Angeles. So you have those to listen to if you want more Motley Crue. Who are we listening to for next week?
Judas Priest.
Oh, nice.
Judas Priest again?
Oh, okay. Hell yeah. All right. Hell yeah.
We only did one of their albums, so we got more to go.
Yeah. I'm going to jerk off that shit.
I got a boner. Well, nice. Yeah. Very cool.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. Take care and have a good day.
Good day.